From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, unrest in South Ukraine as pro-Russian armed men take over Crimea government buildings, as the US warns Moscow against military action.
One official said that Moscow didn't really see any reason to cancel or postpone the war games. The timing of it created a lot of stir and made many people believe that Russia is flexing its muscles as it prepares to go into war with its former Soviet neighbor.
Also today, we look at LGBT rights in the US as Arizona's governor vetoes an anti-gay bill, and we speak to the director of 12 Years a Slave about why he wanted his film screened at the United Nations.
I wanted this particular part of history to sort of be seen and be heard and to be spoken about, and that people will never forget it.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The White House is calling for an orderly return to stability in Ukraine and has repeated a warning to Russia not to take military action in the region. Ousted President Viktor Yanukovych is now thought to be sheltering in Russia. A White House spokesman said he left power of his own free will. Jay Carney was speaking to reporters after Mr. Yanukovych issued a statement claiming still to be the lawful president of Ukraine.
The facts on the ground demonstrate that Mr. Yanukovych created a void by, shortly after signing an agreement, in an orderly fashion, packing up his stuff and disappearing. And it's hard to claim you're leading a country when you abdicate your responsibilities and disappear.
This comes as Ukraine's interim president, Alexander Chernov, warned Russia against military aggression in the autonomous Russian-majority Crimea region. British Prime Minister David Cameron, speaking alongside Germany's leader Angela Merkel in London, says Moscow must abide by its promises on Ukraine.
We both support a united and democratic Ukraine, and we support the aspirations of the Ukrainian people to live in a truly democratic society, under the rule of law, free from corruption and intimidation. We are particularly concerned by the situation in Crimea. Every country should respect the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. The world will be watching.
Crimea is planning to hold a referendum on greater self-rule in May. The vote may challenge the authority of the government in Ukraine's capital, Kiev. Meanwhile, a team from the International Monetary Fund will head to Kiev next week. The IMF team will determine what level of international financial assistance the country needs. On Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry pledged a $1 billion loan guarantee to Ukraine. An accused Cuban spy jailed by the U.S. for the past 15 years has been released from prison and is on his way home to Havana. Fernando Gonzalez is the second of the so-called Cuban Five to be released by U.S. authorities. Our Washington correspondent Simon Marks reports.
Fernando Gonzalez left an Arizona prison at dawn after completing his 15-year sentence for failing to register as a foreign agent and possessing forged documents. He and the other members of the Cuban Five are considered heroes in Havana, where a huge welcome awaits him. U.S. prosecutors accused the Five of being a dangerous undercover spy cell. Havana says they were acting to prevent terror strikes on Cuba. Fernando Gonzalez is the second member of the group freed and is expected to campaign actively for the release of the other three.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. U.S. gay rights campaigners are celebrating a decision by the governor of the U.S. state of Arizona to veto a divisive bill that would allow businesses to refuse service to gay and lesbian customers on religious grounds. The move follows a ruling in deeply conservative Texas, which declared a same-sex marriage ban unconstitutional, marking a series of victories for U.S. gay rights activists. Nina Maria Potts reports.
Arizona's Republican governor, Jan Brewer, had little choice but to kill the controversial anti-gay bill and came under significant pressure from U.S. businesses and gay rights activists. But conservatives are disappointed. President of the Family Research Council, Tony Perkins.
It's now going to be incumbent upon Governor Brewer to say how she's going to protect the religious freedom of thousands of Arizonians who are saying, hey, what am I going to do now?
The move is widely seen as an effort to rescue Arizona's national image, tarnished by anti-immigration rhetoric and gun violence. The veto follows a string of victories over same-sex marriage bans in Texas, Utah, Oklahoma, and Virginia.
And the first major Scottish business has warned it may move south to London if Scotland votes for independence later this year. Insurance, pensions, and savings company Standard Life says it is drawing up contingency plans to move operations from its Edinburgh headquarters. Our UK correspondent Ollie Barrett reports.
Standard Life insists in its annual report it's not taking a stance on Scottish independence, but says contingency plans are necessary to protect customers and shareholders. And among the material issues Standard Life says it's considering are uncertainty over an independent Scotland's currency, membership of the EU, and approach to taxation. Standard Life has around $400 billion of assets under management, so its announcement is a blow to those campaigning for independence. Scotland votes to stay in or leave the UK in September.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Armed men have taken control of and raised the Russian flag over several government buildings in the capital of Ukraine's Republic of Crimea, as the international community warns against escalating unrest. Rival protests in the country's southern region between pro-Western and pro-Russia supporters follows the formation of an interim government in the capital, Kiev. Moscow has warned foreign powers of interfering in the political unrest, as Vladimir Putin ordered a second day of Russian military combat drills near the Ukrainian border. Speaking earlier, White House spokesman Jay Carney repeated that Russia should resist military action.
We are closely watching Russia's military exercises along the Ukrainian border. We expect Russia to be transparent about these activities and to avoid provocative actions.
Meanwhile, theories continue to circulate over the location of ousted Ukrainian leader Viktor Yanukovych, with reports he's been spotted in a Moscow hotel and that he's preparing to deliver a press conference on Russian soil Friday. I discuss the rumours over his whereabouts with our Moscow correspondent, Anya Ardaeva.
From the very first protest in Ukraine last November, Russia took a very strong stance against what it calls extremists and radicals in Ukraine, saying that it views the latest political events there as a coup aimed at overthrowing the country's elected government. It also maintained that it considers Viktor Yanukovych a legitimate president of Ukraine, and it looks like Moscow is now willing to harbor the ousted president. Some reports I heard earlier suggested that Viktor Yanukovych may be hiding in a residence outside the Russian capital. Then it was reported that he may be at Moscow's Ukraine hotel, but no one has actually seen him there. And the latest is that an unnamed source quoted by the Russian news agencies said that Viktor Yanukovych is planning to give a press conference tomorrow in the city of Rostov-on-Don, which is over 600 miles south of Moscow, a surprise development. He also reportedly published a statement in which he said he remains the country's only legitimate president.
As Kiev announced an interim government in the Ukrainian capital, unrest continues in the country's southern region, Crimea. What can you tell us about events there?
Crimea has seen protesters on the streets for several days now, and this region is the only region of Ukraine where the majority of the population is Russian-speaking. There were reports of dozens of heavily armed gunmen seizing control of local government buildings in the town of Simferopol, and on one occasion an estimated 2,000 ethnic Tatars gathered outside the local parliament to show their support for Kiev and the new government there. They clashed with pro-Russian separatists who said that the new government were bandits. And it does feel like Crimea's population is divided. On one side, there are the Tatars, who account for about 12% of the local population and who want to remain part of Ukraine, and the Russians, who account for 58% of the local population, and many of whom denounce the recent political changes in Ukraine.
Fighter jets have been put on combat alert by Russia along its border with Ukraine as Vladimir Putin continues to test Russia's combat, what they call Russia's combat readiness. What message is Moscow sending with this timely military demonstration, and how's that being received by the US and the West?
Russian officials said that the military exercise in central and western Russia has been planned in advance and doesn't really have much to do with Ukraine. One official said that Moscow didn't really see any reason to cancel or postpone the war games because of the events in Ukraine, but certainly the timing of it created a lot of stir and made many people believe that Russia is flexing its muscles as it prepares to go into war with its former Soviet neighbor.
Ukraine is in serious financial dire straits at the moment. The IMF, the International Monetary Fund, has said today that it's ready to help. How bad is the economic situation in Ukraine and what offers of financial support have so far come through?
It is quite clear at this point that Ukraine's economy has reached new lows in the past few months, and this perhaps was one of the main reasons for the uprising there, which resulted, as we know, in ousting of the country's government. Earlier, Russia has promised Ukraine $15 billion in financial aid and even paid Ukraine the first $3 billion in December. The second installment was postponed, and the first one, according to the country's new government, is nowhere to be found now. Ukraine's acting Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk said the country's treasury was empty and that he expects an economic stabilization package from the West soon to avoid a default. Ukraine is now in a massive debt, and that stands at 40.5% of the country's gross domestic product.
Anya Ardaeva in Moscow. The Ukrainian revolution was also topping the agenda during 2 days of talks at the NATO headquarters in Brussels, where the future of Western security forces in Afghanistan was also a priority. Russia's ongoing military exercises on the border with Ukraine forced reactions from NATO officials and sent waves of concern through Western allied states. From Brussels, Jack Parrock reports.
It was set to be a routine meeting of defence ministers at NATO headquarters in Brussels. But as instability worsened in Ukraine, the Western military alliance was forced to react to escalating border tensions with Russia. NATO Secretary General Anders Rasmussen warned Moscow not to take any steps to aggravate the crisis.
We have no information indicating that Russia has any plans to intervene militarily. We need steps that can cool down the whole situation, and that's a responsibility for all parties involved.
The reaction follows a takeover of a parliament in Ukraine's southern and predominantly Russian region of Crimea and a recent Russian military exercise along the Ukrainian border, which NATO admits has not made things easy, and it's rung alarm bells in Washington as well. Despite being concerned about what Russia's doing, officials at the NATO meetings were reticent to accuse Moscow of any wrongdoing. Instead, they urged all parties involved to hold back from action which could cause a flare-up. The US Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, says American and Russian counterparts will be in touch over the next couple of days to discuss the situation.
We're following this very closely, obviously. We all are. The United States surely is. Until we know more details and what's really happened there, who's in charge, I think the focus should be on let's keep the tensions down. Let's see no provocative actions by anyone, any military. These are difficult times. We all understand that. But this is a time for very cool, wise leadership.
Also on the agenda was Afghanistan. US President Barack Obama announced he would pull all troops out of the country by the end of the year if Afghan President Hamid Karzai continues to refuse to sign a bilateral security agreement. That sentiment was echoed here by NATO Secretary General Rasmussen.
Without the necessary legal framework, there simply cannot be a deployment after 2014. No security agreement, no troops and trainers. We agreed the need to plan for all possible outcomes, including the possibility that we may not be able to deploy to Afghanistan after 2014 due to the persistent delays we have seen.
The Afghan security issue, while important in the long term, was slightly overshadowed by the more pressing events currently happening in Ukraine. NATO's influence in the Ukrainian situation may be limited, but it hopes that Russia and Western allies will keep out militarily and allow Ukraine to forge its own future. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
This is FSN Reports. Faced with outcry from corporations and civil rights groups, Arizona's Governor Jan Brewer has vetoed the bill opponents called Turn the Gaze Away, legislation that would have allowed private, for-profit businesses in the state to refuse service to someone if they claim a sincere religious belief. Our correspondent Alice Olstein explains what brought down the Arizona bill and where similar efforts are still moving forward across the US.
when a so-called religious freedom bill in Arizona got consigned to the dustbin of history with a stroke of the governor's veto pen. The conservative group Center for American Policy called it a sad day for Arizonans. They claimed the legislation was necessary to protect individuals from being forced to speak or act contrary to their conscience by serving gay, lesbian, and transgender customers. But when Republican Arizona Governor Jan Brewer explained her veto to reporters Wednesday, she said the bill had the potential to divide the state in ways we cannot even imagine and no one would ever want.
Senate Bill 1062 does not address a specific or present concern related to religious liberty in Arizona. I have not heard of one example in Arizona where a business owner's religious liberty has been violated. The bill is broadly worded and could result in unintended and negative consequences. To the supporters of this legislation, I want you to know that I understand that long-held norms about marriage and family are being challenged as never before. Our society is undergoing many dramatic changes. However, I sincerely believe that Senate Bill 1062 has the potential to create more problems than it purports to solve.
Though Brewer went on to say that non-discrimination is a core Arizona value, some civil rights activists questioned her motives, noting that she signed into law an infamous immigration bill that allowed racial profiling of the state's Latino residents. Much of that law was later ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. Brewer's move in this case came after a chorus of voices across the political spectrum urged her to veto the bill, among them Arizona's Republican senator and former presidential candidate, John McCain.
But I know that the entire business community is galvanized in a way that I've never seen it against this legislation. Their major concern, frankly, is tourism and location of businesses in Arizona.
Several major corporations who do business in the state, such as American Airlines and Apple, had criticized the bill, and a campaign began organizing online to ban Arizona from hosting the next Super Bowl. Eunice Rowe with the American Civil Liberties Union said this push wasn't only about profit.
Many of the companies I spoke out made it quite, they said publicly, it is not just about bottom line issues, but the fact that they employ LGBT people and that they stand against discrimination. And so we thought that brought a very clear message on both those fronts.
In just the past few weeks, state legislatures in Idaho, South Dakota, Tennessee, and Kansas took up but ultimately rejected similar bills. But versions are still pending in Georgia, Mississippi, Oklahoma, and Missouri. Their backers compare them to existing legal protections that allow churches to refuse to marry same-sex couples or even couples who practice different religions, and say employees of private for-profit businesses should enjoy those same rights. Rose Sachs, the senior staff attorney with the ACLU's LGBT project, had a different comparison.
You know, 50 years ago, businesses were allowed to turn people away because of the color of their skin, and we as a nation decided that was unacceptable. And fundamentally, treating people differently simply because of who they are is discrimination. And that's just, there's no way, you know, we think it's inappropriate to allow just a little bit of discrimination here, just as it would have been in any other context. There, many of us interact with people in our day-to-day lives that we don't see eye to eye with, but we do our jobs, and it's the same thing. Once you are a business that offers that kind of service, you don't get to pick and choose who you serve.
Other civil rights organizations, including the Lambda Legal Foundation, pointed out that the bill's impact would have stretched beyond denying service to certain customers. Because of the vague wording of the measure, businesses could have cited religious beliefs in order to skirt regulations on food safety, building codes, and mediation of workplace disputes. Next month, the U.S. Supreme Court will have the chance to deliberate what religious freedom does and doesn't mean for for-profit companies, when they take up a case from the craft store Hobby Lobby, whose owners want to deny their employees health care insurance that covers contraception. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now to Bolivia, where weeks of heavy rain have swelled rivers, flooded homes, destroyed crops and taken the lives of some 60 people in the country's lowlands. The state of Beni has been particularly hard hit, with the farming region losing over 70% of its cattle. To make matters worse, the lack of drinking water, mosquito-borne disease and limited access to isolated communities all adds up to a dire situation. Our FSN Español correspondent Andrea Arenas spoke with Alfonso Simón, a resident in Beni, who has been affected by these severe weather conditions.
My entire family is living in this area. We are having about a 70% loss of the cattle herd in this area. And not only my family, the entire state of Beni in Bolivia is going to be affected in this same percentage, and it's going to be a catastrophic economic year for us and the entire country. We have about 50 people that have been killed lately and for these floods. We're very worried about the health of the entire people. The flood brings all kinds of contamination in its water, and we're having a health and economic emergency, a humanitarian emergency right now in Bolivia.
What kind of support and aid have people in this region gotten from the government or from organizations?
I can confirm to you that all the aid given by the government is not sufficient, and it's becoming a catastrophic situation, especially in the health of children and all these people, 80,000 people, that are living in streets and tents and have to drink and eat from this same water that it's all contaminated.
Is there outside help coming into the Beni?
We've gotten a donation from the United Nations, and we've received the aid of the Argentinian and Peruvian government with two helicopters that are helping into evacuating persons. But from that, we haven't gotten any more aid, international aid or international help.
How do you think that this will affect the Beni, Bolivia and the region in the long term?
Well, in the immediate long term, we all know that after a big flood comes very big epidemics. We have here in Bolivia yellow fever epidemics, and we have dengue epidemics that are already starting to show in the populations in Beni state. But we are still hoping to not have problems like cholera. The sewers have been overflooded, so all the water that already was contaminated with more than 250,000 dead animals is bringing all the sewer waters with it. So in health, we think it's going to be a catastrophe. Economically, if we lose 70% of the herd, of the cattle herd in this area, it's their main work in this state. So people is not going to have any work. And we hope the government or any international institution is going to be given loans or something to reconstruct the industry in this area. And as we see it right now and how things are, it's going to be a poor area becoming poorer. Maybe like the example of the earthquake in Haiti, where people that had little ended up with nothing and no direct help to how to reconstruct this economy.
Why has the government not called a state of emergency yet? And do you think that there is an urgent need for this state of emergency to be declared?
Well, in Bolivia legal system, we have a division in the state of emergency. One that it's called specific state of emergency and one that it's called a disaster area. The state of emergency per se has been called, but that only gives the local government more possibilities to spend their little money in attending the displaced people and the emergency. And that the second one, that is the disaster area, it's a declaration that habilitates local governments to ask for international aid. And this second one, the disaster area declaration, hasn't been made. And that's what we as civil people are asking right now, our government, to please call for the disaster area so we can get the international aid and the humanitarian help that we are desperately needing.
FSN's Español correspondent Andrea Arenas. And finally tonight, 12 Years a Slave has taken the film world by storm. Its unflinching look at America's slave trade has won it international praise and a host of awards and nominations. And it's even prompted the United Nations to hold a special screening at its headquarters in New York. FSN's Nick Harper sat down with the director, Steve McQueen, to find out his reasons for doing the film.
If you want to survive, do and say as little as possible.
people. I don't want to survive. I want to live.
12 Years a Slave tells the true story of Solomon Northup, a free man from upstate New York, sold into slavery in the 1840s and sent to America's South.
Well, boy, how you feel now?
My name is Solomon Northup. I'm a free man.
And you have no right whatsoever to detain me.
You're no free man.
170 years later, and this screening at the United Nations headquarters in New York perhaps proves the global significance of this film. It's not often a film director receives a standing ovation in the United Nations, or, for that matter, gets to shake hands with the UN's Secretary-General. But such is the power of Steve McQueen's film. McQueen told me that remembering this dark part of America's history and presenting it on the big screen was the driving force behind this project.
It's the reason I made the film, because I just felt that there was an amnesia. It's almost like shouting and not being heard. So the whole idea of making this film was that I wanted this particular part of history to sort of be seen and be heard and to be spoken about, and that people will never forget it.
Pick that cut! Move along, huh?
But as well as this act of remembrance, McQueen wants this film to highlight the fact slavery is far from over. 21 million people still suffer it today.
The fact that the Secretary General is here, the fact that there are sort of ambassadors from all over the world here today at the screening, I hope would have some kind of influence on, you know, what's happening today in modern day slavery and what they could do about that.
A campaigner as well as director, McQueen works for the American organization Polaris, which fights to combat slavery and people trafficking in the 21st century, and the British group Slavery International, which fought the abolition of the slave trade back in the 19th century.
I'm hoping that we'll be able to personalise that story. I'm hoping that it'll be able to sort of echo the fact that what happened to Solomon is happening now, and therefore people take it to heart and sort of are active in what they could do about it.
Master brought you here to work.
I don't want to hear a word out of none of you.
McQueen's aim is to provoke conversations, to make people confront the past rather than ashamedly ignoring it. The movie will undoubtedly resonate with African-American audiences, but he told me he hopes people from any background can connect with the film.
It has to do with a person of African heritage, but it's just to do with an individual for me who regardless of if from Africa or Asia or wherever in the world, who has been taken away from his family and held in bondage. So, yeah, it should be a universal response rather than a particularly personal one.
Marker.
Action!
12 Years a Slave has already won many awards, including a Golden Globe and a BAFTA for Best Film. This weekend, it's likely to add Academy Awards to the list, fighting for Oscars in 9 categories. But showing the film here at the United Nations, this body where more than 190 countries are represented, was an opportunity to show the international impact of the slave trade and raise awareness of an issue that hasn't yet fully gone away. Nick Harper, New York.
And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. You can contact us about the show by emailing us reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And follow us on Twitter. We're there, @featurestory. Coming up on Friday, our correspondent will be in Crimea as that highly volatile situation continues to be the focus of the US and international community. Plus, we'll have a preview from our South Africa correspondent on the highly awaited murder trial of former Olympian and Paralympian blade runner Oscar Pistorius. That's Friday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.